Welcome once again to our series, Reasons to Believe, or Catholic Apologetics, or Fundamental Theology. We're talking about how we can reason to the existence of God, Jesus being Messiah, God and man, and that he set up a church, the Catholic Church. My guest once again is Ron Eldred, who is a teacher of history and religion at John Paul II Catholic High. I'm Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus at St. Patrick Catholic Church here at 19th and Poplar. Ron, welcome once again. And we've begun to talk about the proof of the existence of God, not just from St. Thomas' famous five arguments, are from logical reasonings that people have used through history, but experiential arguments, how we could reason that there got to be besides a designer, if there's design, a cause, if there's things caused in the world, but things that anybody can and has experienced. You were talking about Father Aidan Nichols, who has given us several very practical examples. One was from the sense of wonder that we all experience in the world. Another was from the sense of conscience. There's something deep in us that says, do this or don't do that. Can we continue along that line? What arguments does Father Aidan Nichols give for the proof for the existence of God from just human experience?
Well, the reason we're using these experiential arguments, or that is the arguments from people's experiences, because people can relate to that better. And it's the type used more by the church now than was used, let's say, prior to Vatican Council II, when there was a tendency to use the much more logical, rational arguments. Another proof for God's existence offered by Father Aidan Nichols, is the experience of hope. And here Father Nichols is talking about hope for particular things, such as for peace in our time or for good friends, what have you, good things. And what he has in mind is a general attitude of, a general attitude of hopefulness as a response to the future, which so many people evince in quite impossible situations, and which seem almost a necessary condition for the survival of humanity in hard times, end of quote. He says that people, quote, hope against hope that tyranny will be ended, that their children's children will live in to inherit the planet. But even if the worst happened, even if an evil government possessed itself of the world, or a nuclear holocaust devoured the earth tomorrow, people would still go on hoping amidst the ruins. They would crawl out of the holes and burrows and start to pick up the pieces, end of quote. He says that it's natural to us because it is natural for us to hope. In this regard, he asked the question, does this point to anything metaphysical? That is, beyond the physical world.
Spiritual.
Yes. It could be argued, as did French philosopher and dramatist Gabriel Marcel, he's making reference to him, that it suggests an unconscious grasp of the reality of God as the ground and guarantor of human history, of human dignity. In other words, by the very fact that we have hope, could be taken as proof that there is a God that makes things hopeful.
Okay, then I believe there's a poetic line, hope springs eternal within the human breast. And where does that come from? Why in the most terrible times, a sense of hope, things can get better, lies deep within us. Okay, any other arguments? And this is a long word you're going to be quoting here.
Well, this is the epistemological argument. The epistemological argument has to do with how do we know things? How do we know things are true? And Father Nichols tells us that this argument is associated with the late Father Bernard Lonergan. He was a Jesuit priest and theologian. Epistemology is a branch of philosophy that deals with how things are known. Lonergan proposed that the main proof of God's existence is found in the very knowability of the world. For some reason, the world has a design that makes it possible for the human mind to penetrate it by its own thought processes. It is a fact that there is a considerable harmony between the human mind and the world, as is evident from the fruits of science and technology.
All the things that we learn shows us that we can come to know real facts in the world around us.
Well, in addition to the fit between the human mind and the world, I would add that the fact that the human senses are oriented to comprehending the world, I think that goes a long way towards proving God's existence. In this regard, Father Nichols asked, how can we account for these facts? He concludes that the intelligibility of the world requires us to posit the existence of a creative mind, analogous to, but infinitely greater than the human mind, by which the cosmos was brought into being, and this super creative mind, of course, is what we call God.
Okay. any other arguments from reason? And again, we're talking about not proofs from the Bible or revelation, but that anybody who has the right use of human reason or logic could be tremendously helped, we hope, by these experiences that would lead us to posit that God exists or some kind of great intelligent designer exists.
Well, Father Nichols gives us one more argument, and this is called the mystical experience. And this is my favorite one, probably because of my interest in mystical prayer and its relationships to holiness. We delivered an entire series on that subject, the universal call to holiness, back some months ago. But many people in various cultures have claimed that they have had mystical experiences. Some were no doubt insane or deluded, and others might have been, for self-gain, their claims of having some kind of a really close mystical relationship with God. But I think most mystics appear to have been persons of integrity, whether they be Muslim or Jewish or Hindu or Buddhist or American Indian or Christian mystics. And no matter what their religion or their conception of the divine, all genuine mystics share the belief that they have encountered God or established union with the divine in some way, in some manner.
Okay, that's a normal part of history. Integral or honest and upright people of all races and backgrounds have claimed that they experienced God, the otherness of God.
Well, you might recall a number of years ago, John Paul, I think on at least a couple of occasions, called together an ecumenical, actually it was more than ecumenical, it was from religions outside of Christianity to Assisi in Italy, St. Francis of Assisi's hometown, and kind of a world religions prayer meeting.
And he
prayed for peace, yes, and he fell under a lot of criticism for that amongst at least certain Catholics. But all of these religions have a relationship with God. They may not have the fullness of truth that we Catholics, are privileged to have, but nonetheless, no matter what the religion, they can have a very personal, intimate relationship with God. It doesn't necessarily, the conception of God may not be Father, Son, and Holy Spirit like it's been revealed and as we know to be the truth, but nonetheless, it's still the same God no matter what.
An other being of super intelligence, creator, origin of the world, it may differ very much, but there's always through history been this sense, pretty my understanding, when communism took over the world for about 70 years, that was a movement specifically to say there is no God and we're going to destroy the idea of God. Well, that wasn't normal in history.
No.
The atheistic communism wreaked havoc upon the world, showing that to build a world without God, a worker's paradise, certainly didn't turn out as they claimed that it would. And so to eliminate God leaves nothing, in my understanding, but chaos as we read history.
We're mostly interested in Christian mystical experiences, of course. And as we discussed in our series on the universal call to holiness, that many associate union with God with various types of mystical experiences, such as ecstasy or rapture or levitation or auras, locutions, that is voices, visions, stigmata, that is the, you know, the wounds of Christ, fragrances, these are sometimes called heavenly perfume or the odor of sanctity or something of that sort, bilocation, that is being in one place, more than one place at once, apparitions, that is appearances of various saints or Jesus himself or Mary, private revelations and the like. And this might be true. Those are what we call mystical experiences. And many great saints have experienced these types of mystical phenomena.
Well, for instance, Padre Pio, oh, sure. Saint Padre Pio now, was probably one of the best known mystics who had many of these things, as you mentioned, bilocation and locutions and the stigmata, the wounds of Jesus in his hands.
Well, in his case, it was a daily experience. It wasn't something that just happened occasionally with him. It was really his life. Each of these preceding listed experiences is associated with a highly intense union with God, whereby he absorbs, or that is, God absorbs the faculties of the will and the intellect and the memory and the imagination.
So it's an otherworldly experience.
Yes. And does this mean that one at this height always has mystical experiences? And the answer to that, of course, is no. Ordinarily, only saints who possess heroic virtue and lead extraordinarily holy lives experience these extraordinary types of mystical experiences and reach the summit of mystical experience. And in fact, even some of the great saints, many of the great saints didn't have these kind of mystical experiences.
I think they were very, very limited in Teresa or Thérèse of Lisieux.
Oh, yes, and very limited. In fact, I've thinking back about her life, if I recall right, she was, when she was 10 or 11 years old, the Blessed Mother appeared to her in apparition one time.
To heal her.
Yes, to heal her.
Bad sickness.
Yeah, she had some kind of a nervous disorder or whatever that was really, she almost died from it, if I recall right. But I can't think of any other times hardly in her life where she really had a truly genuine mystical experience.
Her great fame is to have done the ordinary things of life with an extraordinary love of God. And that's why the Holy Father, when she was canonized, said she's a saint for modern times.
Yes, this was her little way.
Right.
And recent, she's become, was made a doctor of the church, the 33rd doctor of the church, over a 2,000-year period, these doctors of the church, was because of her little way that this is something that that deals with the universal call to holiness of everyone, laity and not just clergy and or clerics and nuns, but also all the laity as well.
None of these extraordinary mystical experiences, but devotion to duty out of a tremendous love of God and Jesus.
And Mother Teresa, of course, certainly very much followed that that way too.
The ordinary way.
Yes.
I think she often quoted Thérèse of Lisieux.
Yes, she did. Exactly. I think she was named after, if I recall right. She might have been named after Teresa of Avila, but I think it was maybe Lisieux.
But it's amazing that Thérèse of Lisieux became a doctor of the church just maybe several years ago.
Yes. In the 70s, if I recall right.
And that she was held up as a person that anybody and everybody could follow, even though she was a contemplative, enclosed Carmelite nun.
And a young girl. She was only 24 when she died.
And she died. Pretty painful death,
but
I believe.
But a girl who had gone through a lot of experience. She went into the order, I think, when she was 15. She had to get a special dispensation to do so. In fact, she got it from the Pope himself, Pope Leo XIII. And she had the nerve to ask him when she went to her father, took her there, and she had an audience with her and her father had an audience with the Pope.
And they were told not to speak.
Right.
And she goes up and kneels down at the Holy Father's knees and says, "Please, Holy Father, let me go into the contemplative order at Lisieux in France."
Well, if I recall it, I don't think he ordered them to do it back in France. at the local Carmelite. I think.
Well, I think he referred him to the bishop.
Yeah, and you had to go through. You had to go through the channels.
Channels, but it certainly didn't hurt.
Well, she did get in pretty quick after that. But nonetheless, all of us are called to holiness in this life, and each of us are capable of experiencing a close friendship with God if we become holy enough, enough like Jesus. And we can do this only by doing God's will and with the help of His grace, which He offers to us freely.
Let me tell you a story that happened at the funeral reception for your mom at Linda's house. Met a fellow there named Dave, and he has a Jewish name, and I don't want to identify him or embarrass him in any way, but he speaks very freely about it. But I asked him, isn't that a Jewish name? And you're a pastor of a Protestant church. And I said, how did that happen? And he said, well, only by the grace of God. He said, you are looking at a converted, agnostic, self-centered, me-only person for a long time in my life. And then I went bankrupt, and I had no place to go. So I prayed. And suddenly, I was given a great experience of conversion, and I just completely changed my life around. And so it was quite an inspiration, because he says, what I was before and what I am trying to be now is as different as night and day. And that's that. That's kind of a mystical experience.
Oh, certainly.
A contact with God through prayer. Okay, now you're going to quote for us some wonderful results that come from contact with God in prayer or this mystical experiences. I've never heard these summarized before, so maybe we can take them a little slowly, because I think they're so attractive that all of us would like any one or all of them.
Well, you know, people usually, when they think of mystical experiences, they think of the list we gave a while ago, ecstasy,
stigmata,
all those kind of things. But that's extraordinary. We're talking about the more ordinary type of mystical experiences that people who live holy lives and establish some degree of union, you know, with God in this life. And Father Thomas Dubay, who is one of the world's, I think, most prominent mystical theologians and renowned spiritual director. He has a rather lengthy list in his book called Fire Within, and I have a few of them here. For example, peace and refreshment of mind and soul.
Boy, who isn't looking for a peace of soul?
Heroic virtue, the ability to practice virtue in an extraordinary way.
Now we have Mother Teresa, Theodore Guerin, going to be canonized October the 15th, right, from her own St. Mary's
right.
of the Woods, who certainly practiced, according to being canonized, virtue in an extraordinary way.
And, you know, even people that we know, you mentioned my mother a while ago, who died recently, lived, I think, a life of heroic virtue. Then we have innocence of evil.
Now, help me, I didn't understand what that was, innocence of evil.
Well, I think the idea is that people who are really holy, a lot of times find it difficult to see any evil or anything bad in other people.
Okay.
You know, even sometimes to the point of almost a naivete about evil people. And you take a Padre Pio, certainly he never had, you know, as holy as he was, because he had the ability to experience almost the, I forget what that's. Oh, it's reading. Is it reading souls or discerning souls or
discerning
something like
soul.
That?
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, that's a mystical experience,
sure.
Where you're told by the Holy Spirit
and the cure of ours,
right?
That.
And the cure of ours, yes. A cessation of inner suffering, a cessation of imperfections.
Well, excuse me, just a second. You're stressing there of inner suffering, kind of a calming of the conflict.
Yes.
That civil war that goes on within each of us from the wound of original sin.
Yes.
We might have exterior suffering. Okay. Cessation of imperfection. All right, give me an example of imperfection.
Well, I think that in this sense, I think we mean imperfections a little broader than we did when we delivered the series on the universal call to holiness. This would include, I think, even venial sins and things of that sort.
Okay.
In other words, the holier one gets, the more grace one has, and then the more holier one can be.
Trying to be like Jesus.
Yes, trying to be like Jesus.
One of the imperfections I've fought all my life is trying to be on time. And it just seems like no matter how early I try to leave, somebody comes up or something interferes, and I just have to struggle to be on time, which I think we were taught in seminary was the courtesy of kings. Nobody can make you be on time, but it's so helpful to other people that are depending upon us being there.
Another would be remarkable delight in God's creation. And this is associated with what we've been talking about, this idea of wonder. In other words, the holier one becomes, the more ability they have to see God, so to speak, in creation. Not in the pantheistic sense, but in the sense of as the creator and the designer and the cause of all these things.
God's fingerprints,
yes,
being upon everything. There's that beautiful little poem, Earth is crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. But only those who see take off their shoes. Well, that's reference to Moses taking off his shoes before the burning bush. But it's an ability to see in God's creation, God the Creator. Okay.
Another one that Father DeBay gives, this is a constant awareness of God's presence. I think this is one of the most important ones. Remember, St. Paul tells us to pray ceaselessly. As we said in our series, on the universal call to holiness, this doesn't mean that you necessarily have to go around mumbling prayers all the time. It just simply means that people, as they become more and more holy, are more and more aware of God's presence. In fact, God even reaches from his side of the veil that separates us from God and makes us constantly aware of his presence, of his being there. In fact, not only being there, but we believe, of course, in this doctrine of the indwelling Trinity, that a person in the state of a sanctifying grace, that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit actually dwells in their soul. And we get this, of course, from St. John, probably chapter 13 or 14, I believe, if I recall right, where Jesus is giving his last discourse at the Last Supper, where he tells you, you know, that people who do my will, who obey my commandments, my Father and I will come and dwell, you know, within you. And
there's a small book called The Practice of the Presence of God, written by Brother Lawrence. That's sort of a classic. And he was just an ordinary lay brother, but he worked in the kitchen, worked in the garden, whatever he was doing. He just always seemed to be aware that he was surrounded by the presence of God, like he was surrounded by light in the day or night, darkness in the night. So that constant awareness of the presence of God is common if a person really is seeking God.
Ordinarily, we have to make an effort to be aware of God's presence or God being within us, what have you. But the holier that we become, the more I understand, the more that we become aware, that God makes us aware of his presence in us. I used to tell my students, and when I taught to middle school kids religion, I just teach religion in the high school now, but I tell the middle school kids that, you know, I said, you know, when you're tempted by various things, assuming you're not putting yourself in a state of near occasion of sin, you know, and what have you, but when you're tempted by things that, in life, I said, you know, just think about, you know, God dwelling in your soul, about Jesus being there, and you're going to be a lot less likely to do it or to join in with it if you are, you know, thinking about Jesus, because he's right there, you know. he's going to see what you're doing, right, at a pretty close range.
I remember our first grade black-robed, white-wimpled Franciscan nun told us, and it shows how things stick with you when you're very young. She said, now remember, God always sees us. We are always in the presence of God. And for some reason, I guess because she was a very holy nun, a little tiny nun, But that struck with me that wherever I am, and Psalm 138, where can I flee from thy presence? Where can I go from your spirit? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I'm prostrate in the abyss, you are there. It's a whole series of, about being in the presence of God in that beautiful Psalm 138, or 139, because they're numbered differently in some of the new translations. Okay, a constant awareness of God's presence.
Another one is all actions are performed for God. In other words, the holier we become and the more we begin to experience God, to be aware of God's presence. And again, we're using the term mystical in an ordinary way rather than the extraordinary way, that a person becomes more and more performs everything that he does for God during the day. And then finally, there is, Father DeBay gives us here, the fullness of joy. Now, if you'd read his book, The Fire Within, he has probably another 10 or 12 anyway, but I picked the ones that, you know, that I think we could best relate to.
Well, those are beautiful and well said. I believe it was Abbot Marmion, the great Irish Benedictine in France, who said, joy is the echo of God's life within us. And joy is the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience. So, and you know, Jesus said, I have told you these things that my joy may be yours and your joy may be complete. So, if we're looking for joy, which is one of the great gifts of the Spirit, trying to stay in close contact with God, particularly by prayer, is one of the fruits of that.
If I recall right, I think it has a religious meaning, the idea of joy, as opposed to happiness.
Okay.
Happiness could be used in the sense of in a religious sense, but typically we want to use the word joy rather than happiness. But happiness could relate to even secular matters and
sure.
Matters outside.
I'm happy about winning the lottery.
Right, yes, that's what I mean. in that sense. But you wouldn't say I'm joyful for, you know, having won the lottery. At least that certainly would be a wrong way to use the word.
Might spill over a little into joy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, our time's running out. Let's kind of conclude things here.
Well, I think the main thing to remember is that these gifts, these ordinary gifts, are purely gifts from God, and we do not deserve them, but we can cooperate with God's grace to receive them. And God offers each of us the grace to lead holy lives. However, we must use our will to make the decision to accept it. And we can prepare for the infusion of God's grace by emptying ourselves of vices and sin. The recipient of such blessings knows that God truly exists. And those who experience these benefits of union with God simply know with absolute certainty that God exists. That's the whole point. Father Aidan Nichols uses mystical experiences for knowing that God exists. And a person who have had genuine mystical experiences will say, I know Jesus. I know God. I know that he exists.
That's beautiful, Ron. Good words to conclude on. We thank you for being with us. May God bless you always and in all ways.